California's governor gave a very long budget message in January. Today, we get his revised budget with only a few hints so far about how much the numbers might change. On Insight, our bureau chief, Ben Adler, sets the scene from the Capitol. He'll join us live for this week's Capitol Chat. Then we'll get a lesson on school receivership. It's not bankruptcy, but it is an emergency action for a school district that's in fiscal crisis. More about the specifics today from Karen Moore. She's director of the division that oversees some of this process in the State Department of Education. As you make your weekend plans, there's an intriguing film to consider. It's about the Afrobeat music of Cuba called Bacasso. I'll talk with one of the Sacramento brothers who made the film. And then Nick Bruner brings us his music in Sound Advice. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's today on Insight. First, the news. Live from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. This is budget season at the state capitol in Sacramento, and in about an hour and a half, Governor Gavin Newsom will give an announcement that informally is known as the May Revise. This is the update that happens every year in May, an update on the budget message that was given in January. But we've had a transition in governors, and with that has come a transition in style. So listen to a little bit of Governor Jerry Brown from last year.
What's out there is darkness, uncertainty, decline, and recession. So good luck, baby.
All right. Now listen to Governor Gavin Newsom from last week.
Jerry may have said it a little too early. The skies are getting darker on the horizon. But I would be remiss if I didn't say the skies are darkening on the horizon, and we better prepare for that rainy day.
Do you agree with me? Difference in style there. Cap Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler is joining us from the Capitol in the midst of preparations for the presentation today. So, Ben, the style might be different, but you can definitely hear the similarity there in the warning from the two governors.
Well, and that was noteworthy, and your timing is impeccable because I'm here in the Assembly Press Bay, and session has just now been gaveled to order, and so that's what you're going to hear a little bit of in the background today. Now, what was interesting about those two comments to me is Gavin Newsom campaigned for lots of very pricey, big, sweeping changes to California programs and investments, particularly for women, children, low-income minorities. And yet he is exhibiting some of the same caution and warning, even referring to lawmakers as over-exuberant, that Jerry Brown was known for doing as well throughout his time in office. And so I found that to be noteworthy in his remark last week. And yet, you're absolutely right. They have different styles in the way they say things.
Let's get to a bit of the numbers. In January, the governor proposed a $209.1 billion spending plan. Some of that was surplus money. Let's talk about how those bigger numbers might change today.
All right. So there, at the time in January, the governor projected a $21 billion with a B dollar surplus. And that was about $6 billion more than the nonpartisan legislative analyst, which is the state's kind of budget watchdog, projected or had kind of estimated it would be at the time. So a very large surplus, much larger than anything that Jerry Brown ever had to work with. And you'll recall he took office back in 2011 with a deficit that was larger than that surplus. But so it really allowed Newsom to propose what I kind of called a have your cake and eat it too budget. He was able to put extra money aside or call for, because this was a proposal and still is a proposal today, call for putting lots of money, extra money aside in the rainy day fund budget reserve. He was able to try to pay down some unfunded pension debts and other retiree liabilities. He was able to propose lots of one-time investments, and he was able to also propose some ongoing investments. Among the proposals he made were significant increases in higher education, $500 million, I believe, or so for the UC and CSU systems each annually ongoing around there, child care expansion, full-day kindergarten, moving toward universal health care through increased subsidies for middle-class Californians using the health benefit exchange known as Covered California, and expanding Medi-Cal to young adult immigrants living in the state illegally, and two additional weeks of paid family leave. So all of those proposals were in his January budget, and we'll see which ones stay there and which ones are going to be tweaked a little bit as we keep moving.
He's giving us some hints. Over the last week or two, he's been talking about increasing paid family leave. He's also talking about ending the sales tax on tampons and diapers. So he's moving the numbers around a little bit. What else, Ben?
Well, your timing is once again perfect in asking about the proposal that he had this week, or many of the proposals, including ending the sales and use tax exemption on diapers, also on tampons. The author of a bill for several years running to do that just walked into the press bay to join us, and it's Democratic Assemblymember Lorena Gonzalez from San Diego. Hi there.
Hi, good morning.
So this was a few years in the making for you. What do you think made it happen this year?
Well, you know, we've been working on this for about 5 years now, and I think one of the huge differences is we have a governor who has young kids in diapers. So when you start the conversation and he is responding in a way that he completely understands about the cost of diapers, it's a much different conversation.
And so the proposals included sales and use tax exemptions being ended on, or exemptions for diapers and tampons, expansion and childcare, and then some of the things reiterating that he proposed back in January, such as expanding paid family leave, which is going to be a pretty tricky battle, particularly on the job protected end with the chamber. But you know as well as I do that a lot of lawmakers in this chamber, you know, have proposals like this, and certain ones rise to the top and get done in the budget. The governor, previous governor, Jerry Brown, vetoed it, saying it should have been done through the budget process. Couldn't you have done this through the budget process last year if your ledge leadership made it a priority?
Well, it's not just that. Actually, on the diaper front, we tried to get diaper issues into the budget multiple years, different types of diaper initiatives, and often it was taken out at the very end by the governor's office. So it was kind of this circular problem. You know, even if I had the support of my House and even the Senate, at the end of the day, if the governor's not willing to agree to it in a final product, and that's what happened. And so, you know, we knew there was no hope to get the diaper tax under Jerry Brown, and that changed a lot, obviously. And on the paid family leave, it's interesting you said that the job protected issue is an issue, but we also have income replacement as an issue. And so I'm appreciative of the governor, and he really does care about kids and families, and this is clear from his budget. But we need to talk about who right now can actually take paid family leave of 6 weeks. It's great to extend it to 8 weeks or 6 months someday, but if people can't live on 60 or 70% of their income, and you can't do that if you're a minimum wage worker, then just providing additional time to take doesn't help them at all.
Well, for paid family leave, there's the two different parts, as you mentioned, the paid part, which the state can help work to increase, then the job protection, which brings the business community in. And you are in a big battle with the business community and businesses throughout the state over your bill in response to the Dynamics Court ruling, which governs independent contractors and who can be an employee. And you've been moving it through the process. You've got some large groups, including the Chamber of Commerce, in support. Can you update us on this bill and how sure you are that you can get a deal that brings everyone in this year?
Well, you know, I'm not sure we'll get a deal that brings everybody in. I'm sure that I'm fairly certain that we will either move a bill or nothing will change. If nothing changes, I think given the court decision, the Ninth Circuit court decision a few weeks back that says this is retroactive, makes businesses a little nervous. So they need to come to the table as well. We need to have a discussion, but we're not going to give away the farm. I mean, yesterday showed us we had a national Uber and Lyft strike where drivers are talking about their frustrations and having no control over the workplace, their hours, how much they're making. And this is really coming to a head, and we have to have a discussion. If you're a multi-hundred-billion-dollar company and you cannot take the responsibility to pay your workers, and that we as a state aren't serving as a safety net for people who are working full-time, something's wrong with that.
It really shows the gap. In California, you've got between folks with a lot of money and folks with not so much. That's going to be exhibited as Uber begins its IPO, and you know, I believe today, and that's going to bring a big windfall to the state, bringing us back around to the budget today. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And so, Beth, that is Democratic Assemblymember Lorena Gonzalez of San Diego.
You know, one thing that strikes me to follow up on at some point with her, Ben, is that where she began the conversation saying that this governor, because he has four children and certainly has the experience of the cost of diapers, is more amenable to the legislation, the implication being if a bill gets to his desk, he's going to sign it. The flip side of that is that Jerry Brown had no kids. Now, Jerry Brown was saying this was a budget process item to him, but is she also suggesting that because he didn't spend the money on diapers the way this governor is, just out of the box, he would have had a different attitude about it?
That, I believe, is exactly what she was saying. And I've also heard people say it about the governor when it comes to preschool and child care and other issues that families with young kids face.
Members.
Those were issues that I think from time to time, Democrats, actually each year, Democrats tried to get more money into the budget
the
for once the, you know, the budget started rebounding. And so that was something that Jerry Brown said, look, we'll take some each year, but it's going to be, you know, more of a challenge. I'm going to speak a little more quietly now because we're moving into the prayer and the pledge here in session.
I appreciate that, Ben, and maybe we should let you go for the day. Just one last quick question. Anything new, any new hints that you've picked up down there about what to expect in the May revise?
Other than what the governor announced on Tuesday with the diapers and the tampon sales tax exemptions and an expansion of child care beyond what he proposed in the January budget, we're still waiting. I mean, he's dropped tiny hints about very small projects. I think yesterday there was a controversial pesticide that his administration announced that it's banning, and he's going to put some money in the budget to help farmers transition with that. There was also $15 million that he announced for security at places of worship after the shooting at the San Diego area synagogue. But as far as big, significant items that are going to get, you know, that are going to affect large numbers of people, we are waiting to see what he says at 10:30 this morning here at the state capitol.
All right, Ben, thanks so very much.
You're welcome.
That is Cap Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler reporting from the Capitol this morning. The deadline to pass the budget, by the way, in California is June 15th. So there'll be a lot of legislative wrestling that will happen between today's announcement and June 15th. And again, there will be full coverage by the Cap Radio news team of the budget announcement today, continuing throughout the day. So stay with us at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio.
We were alone.
Welcome back to Insight live on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. In the ongoing budget and contract crisis in the Sacramento City Unified School District, school board members will vote tonight on whether to finalize the elimination of 178 positions. If that is finalized, layoff notices would go out to 102 employees, I'm told, next week, and the additional jobs will be eliminated by attrition. Beyond this decision, though, Sac City Unified has a multi-million dollar budget deficit that, if not resolved, could move the district into receivership. And we wondered what that means. What is receivership? So in the studio with me to help answer that question and more is Karen Moore. She is the director of the School Fiscal Services Division for the California Department of Education. Hi, Karen. I guess
Hi.
You're the teacher today. You get to give us the lesson. So receivership is not bankruptcy, correct? And it's a form of bankruptcy, but not technically. It doesn't happen very often, but because it is a fiscal rescue of sorts, will you explain what exactly is involved in receivership?
Well, in the context of government, I think receivership is as good an explanation as any, and bankruptcy is probably an appropriate word to use as well, although whatever measures that we use are all with the goal of keeping the district open and getting it back on its feet. So in the context of a school district, typically what it means is they have run out of cash and they, you know, often can't make payroll. I mean, it comes down to that, essentially, when there are not sufficient options to borrow from the county or the county treasurer. So then they need a state loan.
And in fact, it's that running out of cash that triggers the receivership process.
Correct.
So under California law, a school district can't technically go into bankruptcy.
True. There was a court case back in the 90s, and it was determined that the state has an obligation to keep schools open. It's a constitutional obligation. It's part of, you know, equal protections. And so school districts have to stay open, and the state has an obligation to make sure that happens.
A couple things will happen along the way, and I want to be careful to say that I'm not talking about any specific district at this point, but that there will be a budget crisis, and then, as we were just talking, there will be a move towards a shortage of cash. But some other steps have to happen, including an audit.
Yes. Well, there's multiple audits that happen. School districts are audited every year, for example. They have an annual independent financial audit. There are also measures that are taken throughout the year to make sure that a district is on track, or to try and counsel them if they kind of go off track. So their annual budget is prepared and adopted by the district governing board. It is then reviewed and approved by the County Office of Education. And then in addition to that annual review of the budget, there are two interim reports that are interim reporting periods where two times during the year the district kind of updates their fiscal status, and the county has an opportunity at those times as well to look and assess how the district is doing fiscally. So they're looking at not just the current year, but the subsequent 2 years as well. So it kind of gives them a look into the future if things look like they're turning.
It's important to make a distinction in the word superintendent, that sometimes we have the state superintendent and then we have the county superintendent. They're two different bodies.
Correct.
And they will also be both monitoring different ways a specific school district. So
yes.
In terms of the county role, the county's monitoring as a district is moving through its crises, its audits. And then at some point, there's going to be a decision made that, can I call it a rescue or an emergency action needs to happen?
Yeah.
And then what happens next? Let's say the district runs out of cash. The trigger is present.
Typically, these things don't typically happen overnight, right? People are aware that there is kind of a crisis of sorts that's brewing. And often the district, with the help of the county and sometimes the help of the state, are able to turn things around. So that's always the goal. So there's lots of intervention that happens along the way. It could take, you know, quite a long period of time for something to actually get to such a point where they need a state loan. What was your question again?
And actually, on what you just said, that is what the ultimate goal here is, that there will be an emergency loan made to the school district.
Well, that's kind of the last resort. If nothing else works, then yes.
In the meantime, there's a phrase called negative certification. And if a school goes into negative certification, then what is the status?
A school district can be, they're certified as positive, qualified, or negative. So positive means they're fine. They're going to be able to meet their obligations for the current and two subsequent years. Qualified is they may not make their obligations for the current or two subsequent years. Negative is they won't, without some action, meet their obligations for the current or the immediate subsequent fiscal year. So districts are negative. Sometimes it's not a common thing necessarily, but it doesn't necessarily foretell bankruptcy. Right now, as of the last reporting period, we have 5 districts that were certified as negative. There are some every year. We don't have bankruptcies every year. I think we've had 9 in the last 18 years. So the bankruptcy itself is not all that common. The negative status is, you know, there are usually several a year. I think the high was 13 one year back in the tough economic times. I think we had almost 200 districts that were in a qualified status. So it's a early warning system, and it usually works, and usually things are able to resolve themselves without needing a state loan.
What is the status right now of Sacramento City Unified School District?
They do have a negative certification. As of the first interim reporting period, I can't speak to the second. That should be coming up fairly soon. I'm guessing it's still going to be negative. And there are, as of the first interim period, there were five. And so I don't expect that they will all be bankrupt. I hope none of them will.
There is another district in the Northern California mm-hmm. region that is also in that negative certification.
Correct.
And that
it's
is?
Amador. And actually, it's the County Office of Education. That's a unique one where the county office and the school district share the same governing board. So the state is actually the agency that's responsible for monitoring them and reviewing their budgets and so on. And so the district or the county office, we actually made them negative at first interim. So we have concerns. They're a small agency, and we're hoping that we can work through things and get them through this crisis.
The negative certification originates at the county level?
Well, typically the agency self-certifies for themselves, whether they think they're positive, qualified, or negative. Their oversight agency can change that certification if they disagree. So in the case of Amador, we changed the certification from qualified to negative. And the district is certified as qualified, and we agreed with that certification.
I realize that we're getting a bit in the weeds, and I'm talking with Karen Moore. She's the director of the School Fiscal Services Division for the State Department of Education in California. So back to the concept of receivership. Ultimately, there's going to have to be a loan, but the loan requires a piece of legislation.
Correct.
So it seems logical that if a school district is working on a loan, they're also talking with a lawmaker to work out some sort of legislation. And that also says that every school that goes into receivership would have a unique bill connected to it for its loan.
Correct. Yes.
And then lawmakers will discuss it. It has to be approved. It goes to the governor's desk. All that sounds like it could take a lot of time.
These things can happen fairly quickly. It depends, for starters, if the legislature is in session. That is important. But these are typically urgency bills that can move fairly quickly through the legislative process. These things, as I've said, we hope that it doesn't come to where they need a state loan, right? So people are aware. The county office is intimately involved. The state has a role. Probably their legislators already know that this district is in financial crisis. And I'm speaking generally. Certainly in the case of Sac City, I'm sure, you know, we are the capital. So I'm sure everybody is more than aware. But everybody is aware. I think everybody is ready or willing to act if need be. But I think we need to exhaust all measures. I think everybody is looking to exhaust all measures to make sure that they can make whatever cuts that they need to make, that if there's borrowing that can happen without needing a state loan, that can happen. And then when all of those avenues are exhausted, then the state loan becomes a reality. And things can move fairly quickly, I think. There is certainly a willingness to, and people agree that we need to make this happen. You know, people need to get paid, and the district needs to go on, so.
So that raises the question, how often has this happened? How many schools have gone into receivership and might still be in? And then how often do schools get out of receivership and get rolling again on their own fiscally?
So I said from 1991 to now, about the last 18 years, we've had nine. For the 10 or 12 years before that, we had 28, I think. So what happened was when the Richmond School District got a loan back in early 90s. There was a bill. It was called AB 1200. It was authored by Delaine Easton, who later became the state superintendent. And it established some oversight measures that's what we use now. And so I think it's been very effective over time. So that's where the budget review and those interim reports that I talked about, that bill created an organization called FICMAT, the Fiscal Crisis and Management Assistance Team. So there's lots of work that goes around monitoring and oversight to help with that process. So it has happened nine times in the past 18 or so years.
And of those nine, how many are still in receivership right now?
Four. Yeah. Four still have loans. Three of those districts have what we call a trustee. One of those districts has an administrator where they have full control of the district.
Again, I'm going to walk a bit into the weeds here on this. State law changed in a trailer bill last fall that shifted the oversight from the state to the county. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get too deep into it, but in terms of what you just said, the trustee or the state administrator, mm-hmm. and these would be the individuals that step in to take over in place of the school board or the superintendent. Who directs and guides those people changed?
Yes. So it used to be, it's called a state takeover, and it's called a state administrator, where the state comes in and has control. That responsibility has shifted back to the county office. We don't have any districts that have gone bankrupt and gotten a loan under this new process. So I don't know exactly how it will work. But what I do know is for the four districts that still have outstanding loans, in three of the cases, we had a state trustee, and I'll explain that. In one, we had a state administrator. We had contracts with them. So we had to revise those contracts to turn them back to the county so that the county now is responsible for those districts. So back to the administrator versus trustee. When the loan is significantly large, if the loan request is 200 times the amount of their recommended reserve for economic uncertainty. So that's the amount that they're required to set aside for reserves. If the amount of the loan is 200 times that amount, then they require a state administrator. And what that means is, and I say state administrator, now I guess it's a county administrator, but it's hard to change that term. It means that person comes in and essentially runs the district. They act as the superintendent, they act as the board. They kind of have full control, and they work with the community. There are lots of laws surrounding how they are supposed to act and who they're supposed to consult with people. But ultimately, the decisions are theirs, along with now the county office. It used to be the state.
So whichever school district might go into receivership mm-hmm. next becomes the school district that goes through this process mm-hmm. since the change in the law for
yes.
the first time.
Correct.
And there's still state involvement because
yes.
the state gives the county a list of people to choose from.
Mm-hmm.
The county puts them in place. The school district pays for those people
yes.
to oversee. And the state still has some involvement, as
Correct.
I understand.
The state superintendent still has a role. The State Board of Education has a role. FICMAT is kind of in an oversight role as well.
To help the school district get out
yes.
of that situation. So maybe a district would want to go into receivership because it's run out of cash and it has no choice.
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't a school district want to go into receivership?
I think two primary reasons. One is it loses control of the district. The board members become advisory only. They don't have a specific role. They don't get paid. The district superintendent is no longer there. It is the administrator that comes in and takes over. So while the administrator is working with the locals, ultimately it's this person's decisions that kind of control the district. And the goal is to get them out of receivership. And the other reason is it's expensive. It's a state loan that can take up to 20 years to repay. There's interest. They're paying for the trustee or the administrator. They're paying for additional studies that might have to be done. They're paying for an audit that's probably more expensive. So it's not necessarily a cheap proposition.
What's the range of loan amounts that you've seen in receiverships?
In recent history, in the last 18 years or so, I think the low has been $1.5 million-ish. And the large was $100 million. That was Oakland Unified.
So as we move forward, are there any other anticipated changes to the process? It is somewhat new because of what just shifted last fall. On the other hand, it's a process that has been in place and that has been working for a few decades now for schools that need it.
That's hard to say. There have been, since AB 1200 was first enacted, there were changes along the way in some ways to strengthen some of those requirements and some, I'll say tweaks along the way. This is kind of a fundamental shift, moving the the primary responsibility back to the county. So it's hard to say whether there might be some other changes along the way. It's possible as we kind of work through this process. And it's also, I think, a reality that with each specific emergency loan, there are sometimes little different conditions that are assigned to them. And so depending on the next one to come up, there might be some nuance, something that is people feel is necessary to add to the legislation.
As I said, this has been a lesson in receivership. We aren't applying it to any specific district at this point. Is there anything else to know about it? And we're both aware that we're sitting here having this conversation at a very tenuous time. The trigger, again, as you said, would be a district running out of cash. That doesn't seem to be anything arbitrary. Anything else to know in this lesson about receivership in California?
No, I would just say it's not a lot of fun for anybody, right? And I think whatever can be done to kind of forestall that or and avoid that would be good. So, you know, whatever people can do to work together, whatever, you know, the county is, I think, willing to step in and help. We're willing to step in and help. And so we hope that things, you know, work themselves out as many of them have in the past. So,
Karen, thank you for saying yes. Thanks for coming in to teach us a little bit about this. I think that this is a conversation that's going to expand over time, and I appreciate the information.
Thank you.
That is Karen Moore. She's director of the School Fiscal Services Division for the California Department of Education. Our newsroom is going to follow the results of tonight's vote by the Sacramento City Unified School Board, and you can find that coverage at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. This is Insight Live on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruryak. Bacasso, spelled B-A-K-O-S-O. Bacasso is a musical genre. It might seem unfamiliar, but it's probably more recognizable than you think. It is a sound that has been sampled in songs by Mark Antony and Janet Jackson, for example. It's Cuban-born music, but the story behind it hadn't really been told until now. A new documentary called Bacasso, Afro Beats of Cuba, tells the story behind the genre. The film is produced by two Sacramento-born men, producer Khalil Jacobs Fontauzi and his brother Eli Jacobs Fontauzi. And Eli's on the phone with me right now. Hi, Eli. Thanks for joining us on Insight.
Thank you. Good morning.
How do you explain Bacasso?
Bacasso, as you said, is a new genre of music born in Santiago de Cuba. And the way that it came about is the African medical students would come to Cuba to go to school. And, of course, they bring their culture, tradition, and music. So they brought the Afro beats of West Africa. And then the Cubans started taking their own take on it and creating a new music sound. And now that's what's spreading through the world.
Growing up in Sacramento, how did you become exposed to it? Do you remember when you first heard the sound and thought, what is that?
Yes, I do remember. I went to Einstein Middle School and then Christian Brothers, and it was in high school that I started to hear the music coming out of the continent, Afrobeats music. And a little bit later, I went to Ghana, West Africa, to study there. And I got really close to the music. And so when I went to Cuba and started to hear the sound, I said, this is incredible. This is something that needs to be documented and shared.
I think we should give everybody a sample of the music, Eli, and then we'll talk a little bit more. But this is Bacasso. Yeah. Sono chicharrón y los pino, sono chicharrón y los pino. So that's actually, I think, the title track from the film, isn't it, Eli?
That is correct. And that energy and that excitement is what you'll see in the film. That's Oscar Delgado with Cameroon. And what they're saying in Spanish is, come and dance to this new rhythm, Baco Sol. The people are dancing into it to the streets. The kids are dancing into it in their houses. So, yes, it's so great to hear it on the radio. it's exciting.
Well, congratulations on making the film. Tell me about the story in it and the star.
The star of the film is named DJ Hiway, and we have him with us. He's going to be in Sacramento tomorrow night. He came all the way from Cuba to share this genre and share the experience with you all. So it follows him back to his hometown of Santiago, and he kind of brings us to the founders of this new genre, the biggest proponents of this new genre, and also some of the educators from Casa Cultura, and who could give us a historic context of how this came about. So that's what the film is. You get to see in his grandma's house, getting the blessing from his grandma. It's a really intimate portrayal of what life is like and how this genre came about.
The premiere of that film is, as you said, tomorrow night at the Guild Theater at 8 o'clock. The film is Bacasso, Afro Beats of Cuba. You mentioned grade school. Where did you and Khalil go to high school, and who hooked you on the idea of filmmaking?
Yes. So we both went to Christian Brothers High School in Oak Park, and I remember actually taking a multimedia class in Sacramento State. That was Sac City University. We were both in high school, but we took some classes at Sac City, also in the African Studies department there. And it really helped shape us of being on the path of loving culture, of the importance of storytelling, and wanting to create a better world through telling stories.
Hmm. Well, Eli, as you know, we didn't have a lot of time today, but the next time you and Khalil are in town, I'd love to again invite you to the studio, sit down and hear more about what you've done, not only with Bacasso, but with the ability to make film and share messages and music from around the world. Would that be possible?
That would be great. And we're honored to be on your show. Thank you so much for the opportunity. And we love Sacramento. And we can't wait to come back home.
Oh, it'll be a great homecoming. Thanks again, Eli. Glad to have you on Insight. Say hello to Khalil.
Will indeed.
Okay. Ciao. That is Eli Jacobs Fantauzi. The film is Bacasso, Afro Beats of Cuba. It's at the Guild Theater tomorrow night, Friday night at 8 o'clock. We'll post a link with more information and a video as well. And now we're going to wrap up the hour with a little bit of sound advice from Nick Bruner. He's host of the music program Hey Listen. And I talked with Nick yesterday about his choices for some new music. All right, Nick, sad songs, surprising turns, and local artists.
Yeah, man, there's a handful of just sad songs that I have just been dwelling on for the past couple of weeks. And we're going to start with one of them by a San Francisco songwriter named Field Medic.
Bottle smile lover, she's just my friend. Thinking.
How sad is that?
in the first phrase, mm-hmm. already the sadness is so strong. It makes me wonder what makes a good sad song, because I was thinking, is it his voice, his lyrics? Wow, I really felt that.
Yeah, I mean, it starts off, the whole record I love. It starts off with sort of a sparse and twangy Hank Williams vibe. And then it sort of turns into, by the end of it, it's got some more electronic synth and loops, and it kind of winds up like, you know, a band like maybe the Postal Service or something like that. But his voice, it's just so vulnerable and wavering, but it's strong, it's contemplative. I love it. I love it.
I don't want to sound cliche like all these vocal competitive shows on TV, but you want to believe it.
Yes.
And that's the thing about, for me, is his sadness seems so authentic. I really believe that he's hurting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree completely. I don't know. I feel like I've read any number of clickbait pieces on the web in the last couple of years about how this generation is obsessed with authenticity and da 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 da. I don't know. For me, it's just a feeling. I mean, like when I believe it or when it resonates with me, it's usually all it takes.
Mm. Are we going into more sad music?
No. We are going into a woman who's responsible for the saddest song I've ever heard, which I have linked to the blog for this edition of Sound Advice. Her name is Aldis Harding, and she is a New Zealand... she's been kind of couched as like a folk songwriter. I'm not sure how much I believe that agree with it myself, but the title track to her new album, Designer, is something I was not expecting.
Your angle with that visionary shimmer, a strange thing to roll out a spell.
Listen to Donovan.
Yeah.
That's a real sense that I get with listening to that track especially. But yeah, like Sunshine Superman or Season of the Witch, that kind of delivery that she has, it's sort of punchy and jaunty and playful. Got a strong Donovan vibe off of Designer.
I get it now. She's definitely your surprising turn, because if she went from the saddest song you'd have ever heard to that, which is really, you know, happy and light and playful.
I put in that record and I braced myself, and then I was pleased to find that it was she's kind of relaxed a little bit on that record, and it just sounds like she's in a better spot herself.
You're listening to Nick Bruner. He's the host of Hey Listen on Saturday nights, and you're listening to him on Insight with this week's Sound Advice. All right, where to next?
Well, you know, I'm frequently pegged as a music snob, for better or worse, Beth. It's just something that kind of comes to the territory. And if you notice, I'm a big fan of country and Western music. I have almost no use for what's on top 40 style country, like your Brooks and Dunns and most of like the big flashy main stage shows.
Right.
But I do love that sound, that twang. And so I was really surprised to find that Sub Pop had recently signed a artist who wears a fringe eye mask. He has a penchant for art house cinema. Before you think I'm describing an overly chatty Sacramento barista, I will tell you that his name is Orville Peck.
So sure. that I've been before. I've seen rattlesnakes behind every door. I've been around this world and now everything's a bore. I don't know that much, but I know about keeping score. And if there's one thing I know for sure, it'll be a long cold day in hell when I take you back.
Pretty classic sound.
Right?
Yeah.
That came out this year.
Really? I hear a little Johnny Cash in there.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely some Roy Orbison.
Ah, Roy Orbison is on my notes as well. Oddly enough, like the Roy Orbison one wasn't the first association I made. It was Chris Isaak, like singing a country western ballad. That was probably when I had a different track. But
just a side note here, for as much as you like country, I have to say, you don't bring it in to Sound Advice as much as you might have. Really.
I wonder if it's not like a recent turn, because last year I put out an episode of Hey Listen that had like almost every song had some kind of callback to that, you know, kind of Western ramble sound. I'm going to start wearing spurs here before too long, Beth.
You would surprise a few people. Wear it with your orange sunglasses. Yeah.
This is one of my favorite records this year. It's called Pony, and it merits repeat listens. And I think just Orville Peck, which is a stage name, as you might guess, is just fantastic, especially for anybody who's even country curious. Jump in on this one.
All right. We have time for one more.
Okay. This is a band called Taco Cat. They're out of Seattle. We're going to end in a happier place than we started this weekend. And I've been lucky enough to have been listening to this album for the last 2 weeks. It just came out a couple of days ago. It is solid pop fun.
That's a nice place to leave us this week, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you like that one. I really dig it myself. Just start to finish, again, that record, too. It's rare that I put a record on and then don't skip a track. But This Mess Is a Place, the new Taco Cat record, it's been one of them.
Reminds me a little bit of Dog Party.
Oh, yes. I can see where you would make that association, sure.
The sister sound. So when you find a record you like, is it the only thing you play for 2 weeks, as you just said, or are you rolling it in with a couple others?
I try to roll it in with a bunch of new stuff. Like, if I'll feature a record, and you'll have anywhere between 2 and 4 tracks over the 2 hours of Hey Listen. Sometimes it's just one that I absolutely love. It just kind of depends on what else is available and new and grabbing my attention that week.
All right, before we go, there is a big and becoming so popular concert coming up that I want you to talk about.
Ah, yes. So thanks to NPR Music, and I believe it's the 5th year of the Tiny Desk Contest, me and 2 other Cap Radio contributors, our intrepid intern Camille Escovedo and last year's concert headliner Lillian Francis, are sorting through the local entrants, and we are going to have a big, fat blog post going live very soon that highlights some of our favorites. And from those favorites, we'll also be picking 3 acts to play out in our garden on June 1st for the 2nd, I hope, annual Tiny Desk Sacramento show.
And just a heads up, that is a sellout concert. So I don't even know if tickets are still available at this point.
Tickets are, as of this recording, not yet available, but the announcement will be coming very shortly, end of this week, I believe, that you can buy the remaining tickets that we have left. Last year sold out in a big, fat hurry. So, yeah, keep your ears peeled, because we're about ready to make the announcement that tickets are on sale very, very soon.
All right. And again, it's June 1st.
June 1st.
In the Cap Radio Garden.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Nick.
Thanks, Beth.
And that was this week's Sound Advice. You can hear Hey Listen, hosted by Nick Bruner, every Saturday night from 8 to 10 on CAP Radio. And we have one more special programming note. Tomorrow at this time, at 9 a.m. and at 7 p.m., I hope you'll tune in for a program called After Paradise. It's the last program in a series from North State Public Radio in Chico, and it commemorates the six-month anniversary since the beginning of the campfire. Again, that's tomorrow, right here at CAP Radio at 9 a.m. and 7 p.m. And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Insight is produced by Bert Johnson, Kate Gonzalez, and Cody Drabble. Our digital team is Chris Hagan, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Today's engineer is Anthony Van Hook. Our senior producer is Helen Barrington. And Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. We're going to close the show with more of the music that you heard in my conversation about the documentary Bacasso. This is the title track, Bacasso, and the film again is at the Guild Theater in Oak Park tomorrow night, May 10th at 8 p.m. So check it out online and enjoy the music.
Música de negro fino, afrocubano el estilo, santaguero, sandunguero, guerrero como los maceos guajiros. Un sonido palentino que dice quién somos y de dónde venimos. Para los bailadores del mundo, otro para los afrolatinos. Fuego, 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 hermano. Este ritmo suena bueno, hermano. Bendecido por el cielo, hermano. En mi tierra no se juega, hermano.
Bacasso.
Lo bailan los niños, que te lo traigo yo.
Bacasso.
Se escucha en la casa.
Bacasso.
Se escucha en la casa.
Bacasso.